Welcome to First Edition. I'm your host, Dr. K, sitting in for Sean Yost. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Later on in the hour, we speak with pastors from Baltimore City to get their perspective on how the church should respond to issues of race and the responsibility that they have to this city. We want to remind our listeners to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 889. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition. Also, connect with Sean on his personal Twitter account at Sean Yost and on his Facebook page, Sean Yost, with information, insight, and breaking news. We begin our conversation speaking with former White House advisor, civil rights activist, minister, founder, and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton. He is leading more than 1,000 faith leaders in the Minister's March for Justice, which will be held in Washington, D.C. on August 28th, the 54th anniversary of the March on Washington. The call is for ministers of all faith to march along with other participants from the Martin Luther King Memorial to the Department of Justice. Reverend Al Sharpton, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to First Edition.
Well, thank you, Professor Whitehead. Very happy to be on with you.
I am very excited. Can you talk a bit about the goals from the first March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, and how is that different from this year?
Well, you know, the goals of the first march, Wyatt T. Walker, Reverend Wyatt T. Walker, who was the executive director for Martin Luther King's organization, Southern Christian Leadership Conference at that time, was our first chairman of the board. And he told me the backstory of that march, because I was too young for the march. I was only 9 years old in 63. And he said that A. Philip Randolph, who was the labor leader, and Roy Wilkins, the head of NAACP, James Farmer from CORE, Dr. King, Dorothy Height, and others got together because A. Philip Randolph had been threatening a march on Washington since the 40s. And they felt it was time to bring the plight of blacks and others, segregation, was still the law of the land in the South. The economic plight, which unions were concerned about, and the criminal justice system. And you have to remember in 63, the right to not protect it. And that was the impetus for the march. And Randolph made the call. Dr. King ended up being the main speaker. And in his speech, he talked about voting rights. He talked about criminal justice reform. He talked about economic rights and jobs and health care. Here we are 54 years later on the 28th Monday coming, and we are faced again with a threat to the progress in those areas. We are seeing all over the country moves toward voter suppression, whether it's purging voters off the books, whether it's trying to end early voting days, Sunday go to the polls days, that this present Trump administration is supporting these moves that are suppressive. We see that they've spent most of their first 8 months trying to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. We see that they have said in the area of criminal justice that they are not going to continue the moves toward police reform and commuting low-level nonviolent drug offenses from these huge sentences that don't match the crime. So we're going to say that you've kept the bust of Dr. Martin Luther King in the Oval Office. It was a big question when Trump went in, would he keep the bust in of Dr. King that Obama put in? You kept the bust in, but you kicked the dream out because you are policy-wise supporting voting suppression. Policy-wise, supporting end of police reform and criminal justice reform. policy-wise, fighting against health care. And on Dr. King, the anniversary of the Dream speech, we wanted the faith leaders, because Dr. King was a faith leader. The name of his organization was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Faith leaders have not spoken up. We've seen the evangelical Christian right stand up with Trump, stand up with the right wing. Where's the faith leaders to stand up and say, wait a minute, there must be a moral agenda that Dr. King represented that is raised in these times?
Now, the reason why I wanted you to frame that, and I do appreciate that, is that some people don't realize the number of people that were involved in the March on Washington. When we teach it in schools, we talk about the I Have a Dream speech and don't mention the people that you just talked about. A. Philip Randolph, you know, from the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, talking about John Lewis, really, in his first introduction to the national scene, talking about Bayard Rustin and Roy Wilkins from the NAACP, really helping young people to understand that to pull off something that you're planning to do on Monday, it takes hundreds, maybe thousands of organizers to pull this together. So with this march, how can people be involved? Should they sign up first? Are they just coming down and joining you on Monday? Are you reaching out?
People should come, and we're gathering at 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. at the Martin Luther King Memorial. And we're asking 1,000 ministers to lead it, but everyone is welcome. You might remember in 2013, we had the anniversary march. We had over 200,000 people come out.
I was there.
We focused this time on ministers because the silence of the church is betrayal. To see all of what's going on from voting suppression to Charlottesville, and we've not heard from the ministers, black, white, Muslim, Jewish, all of them, is a betrayal of silence. Well, so we want them out front, and I'm glad we called on those clergy that are coming to be part of that 1,000 to go to nationalactionnetwork.net, www.nationalactionnetwork.net, and sign in. And we've been able to sign in rabbis, imams, ministers. It's time for us to raise the moral voice. As you see, Professor, that President Trump and the right have tried to dismiss it as extremist on both sides. Well, if faith leaders stand up, he can't dismiss that. He can't act like these are just some thugs or somebody causing problems. It's time for us to do what Dr. King did, have the right people challenge for the right reason from the right base and the right perspective.
Now, just to add to that, because we know we are also in the age of Black Lives Matter, which was primarily organized by young people coming either from the universities, which reminds me, of course, of the Civil Rights Movement. You had these university students, and it was also organized by people on the ground, not connected to universities, not connected to churches, but living in the communities where the brutality was taking place. So as the faith leaders stand up, where is the place for this other group that, in a lot of ways, have been doing some heavy lifting for the last few years?
Well, I think that all of us need to be working together, and I think that we have. You've got to remember that Black Lives Matter started by three courageous sisters with a slogan after Trayvon. We were the ones that did Trayvon.
Right.
And Michael Brown in Ferguson, and Eric Garner is still with that case now in New York. So it was not just, I think that you've got to remember there were the Freedom Riders. Mm-hmm. And there was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you mentioned John Lewis, at the same time as Dr. King and Roy Wilkins. Everybody had different roles at the same time.
Right.
So they're different roles now at the same time. Those that have organized around Black Lives Matter, which is an organic organization because it's not one group, there are different factions that do different things. At the same time, we're doing different things. There's not one case or situation that has happened in the last 5 years that National Action Network has not been in the forefront of, or the NAACP. And there was the organic approach, and there was the social media approach. So it's not where does anybody fit. We all been fitting doing our things the way we do it, the way we always historically did it. We had SNCC and the Freedom Riders and Adam Clayton Powell and Thurgood Marshall and Fannie Lou Hamer and Dr. King all at the same time. So how do we get to the 21st century with all this technology and we can only have one group?
Well, Well, that's why I love listening to you on the radio, because every time it is a history lesson to help remind us that the work we're doing now is built on the foundation that was laid a while ago. If you're just joining us, you're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. I'm Dr. K, sitting in for Sean Yost, and we're speaking with the Reverend Al Sharpton about the upcoming Minister's March for Justice, which will be held on August 28th on the 54th anniversary of the March on Washington. Reverend Al, as we think about the Civil Rights Movement and when we think about the moment that we are in now, can you outline for us just two or three lessons learned from the Civil Rights Movement that we can directly apply at this moment?
Well, I think that one lesson is that we've got to always establish early and remind ourselves often what is the goal. And the objective, the goal, ought to determine the strategy. A lot of times, I've found that we get more caught up in the tactics than the goal. Is the goal to win a case against a bad cop? Or is it to change a law around policing? Or is it to bring about affordable health care, which is legislation? So one, we must have stated goals. Then the tactic must apply to the goal, or which is the best way to achieve it. And I think that that is the first lesson. Goal and tactic must be connected. Secondly, I think that we must have the ability to coalesce and work across the lines with people that may not be in our particular belief system or our particular way of life, but that will support the goals and are needed, because movements are about addition, not about subtraction. And lastly, we must have room for people that have different styles and different methods of organizing. So you have some young activists that like to deal with organic movements and don't like the traditional leader hierarchy base. But then you have some young people that do. There are as many young people that are members of National Action Network or NAACP as there are in other areas. You had to remember, Professor, that in the early 60s, you had SNCC and then the Panthers and those that did the freedom movement in Mississippi, who were the young activists that challenged Dr. King. But you had John Lewis and Jesse Jackson and Julian Bond that joined Dr. King, who were the same age. So I think part of what the media tries to do, because they deal with their buddies, their friends, is act like because there's one segment that's friendly to them, that represents all of that generation. That diversity among young people and old people. Everybody old is not with the traditional. Mm-hmm. I think that we've got to have enough room for everybody. If you're comfortable dealing with organic movement, do that. You're comfortable dealing in self-defense, do that. You're comfortable in church-based nonviolence like I am, do that. Why do we have to choose between each other when all of us claim we're trying to get to the same place?
Right, I completely agree. So, Reverend Al, I wanted to talk to you a bit about Charlottesville. You brought it up earlier in terms of it's time for ministers to kind of take that moral voice. What is your feeling about what we should learn from what happened in Charlottesville? Who should be willing to put their body on the line? How do we attack white supremacy in the ways in which it's coming at us now?
I think that we must attack it several ways. One, to counter protesters by raising the issue, by being there, by standing up, I think was the right thing and important thing to do. I think we must also attack it by legislation. There should not be allowed to have people whose only place in history was fighting to overthrow this government, to preserve and maintain enslaving of Africans from America. And I think that we ought to make it a hate crime to in any way assault, less known murder, like we saw in Charlottesville, a person because you are a white supremacist or neo-Nazi. When we see people marching with torches, talking about Jews will not take our place, talking about the things that they did, then we must have the full weight of government to protect people against that. And for the President of the United States to say there were fine people on both sides, what is fine about a neo-Nazi what is good or fine about a white supremacist? To give a moral equivalency is why moral leaders need to stand up, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what we're going to do on Monday, August 28th.
Now, Reverend Al, you've been on the front lines of this battle for a long time. I mean, you've seen it in many different iterations. A lot of people seem to be confused and think that we're looking at the beginning of something, the rise of neo-Nazis, the start of white supremacy. How would you respond to that?
I would say that, first of all, the title neo-Nazi tells you that this happened before. Neo means new, which means there had to be an old. And in order to know how you defeat the neo-Nazis, find out how we defeated the original Nazis. There was George Lincoln Rockwell and the American Nazi Party in the days of Dr. King and Malcolm. And we fought them with legislation. We fought them with student movements and ministerial movements like Dr. King. There was this whole slew of strategies that even if they didn't get in a room and strategize together, they complemented each other in action. And that is why we cannot let people play the game with us today of divide and conquer, choosing this or that. Are you with this group or that group? Do you like a Sharpton or do you like a Cory Booker? Mm-hmm. We can't afford to be divided. We had Fannie Lou Hamer and Malcolm X and Adam Clayton Powell and all Martin Luther King all at the same time. We don't have to choose one now. We need everybody to have all hands on deck. And I think that this is not new. Any wise people study their history so they can eliminate what didn't work, use what does, update it, and upgrade it. That's what history is for. And I think that anyone that tries to divide us from our history and act like we the new thing are setting you up because they know a tree can't stand if it cuts their roots.
Now, I wanted to ask you, this weekend, of course, we lost one of the greats. I'm talking about, of course, Dick Gregory. And I would like to have you just reflect on that and tell us some of the lessons that we can learn from his long, extensive work to battle against the demons of white supremacy in this country.
I've known Dick Gregory since I was a teenager. You know, I became youth director of the New York chapter of Operation Breadbasket under Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend William Jones when I was 13. And Dick was a hero of mine then. And I met him when I was 16, and we were close all the way to the end. 2-3 months ago, I went spent evening with him. He performed at B.B. King's in Times Square, New York. The thing that you must remember about Dick gave up the most lucrative career of a black comedian in his day. When I was a kid and first met him, Dick was the first black comedian that would go on the Tonight Show that could pack white clubs. And he walked away from that to march and go to jail. He lived a life of total sacrifice and commitment. Wasn't that he couldn't have been successful. He was. He sacrificed for it. And he used to always say to me that you're defined not by what you have, but you're defined by what you stood for. And he personified that. There were times that he would spank me and say, Sharpton, you shouldn't let them get you to do that. Sharpton, you shouldn't have done that. But he was always by my side, always ahead of me, and I was by his side. He never, ever left the battle. He was the generation ahead of me, more Reverend Jackson and John Lewis and Andy Young's generation. But that was the generation that raised me. And that is why I have such deference for him, because you don't need people that are going to mentor you and raise you, that are always going to agree with you. You need them that will discipline you and chastise you. And Dick would do that, but then he'd also fight you on your behalf because he'd tell everybody else, wait a minute, I can correct him. You can't. This is family. We freedom fighters. We will miss him. There's no one that has sacrificed more for as long and strong as Dick Gregory. As we look now at young people that are coming along, like Colin Kaepernick, who we support, and we see him putting his professional career on the line, that's Dick Gregory times 10, because Dick did it when there was no celebrity to it. He went to jail. He went to jail in the 60s with Martin Luther King Jr. and Selma in Birmingham. He went to jail 25 years later with Martin Luther King III and myself in St. Louis, his hometown, when we were there protesting how blacks couldn't get construction jobs on I-70. He spanned the generation. He fought a good fight. And the reason I know he will rest in peace is he lived in peace because he knew who he was and he fulfilled his purpose.
Thank you so much for just kind of helping us to remember Dick Gregory. Thank you for your words and wisdom as we think about what we should be doing at this time. We look forward to this march that's taking place on August 28th, which is the 54th anniversary of the March on Washington. It's the Minister's March for Justice. You are meeting, sir, if I'm not mistaken, at 10 a.m. at the Martin Luther King Memorial.
That's right. And you said you were there with us for the 50th anniversary.
Yes, sir.
I'm looking for you on Monday morning. You may not be a preacher, but you're a teacher, and we need you.
And I will track you down, as I'm a PK, I'm a pastor's daughter, so I will track you down, sir. Reverend Al, it has been a pleasure of mine. You've been a hero of mine for quite a long time. It has been a pleasure having you on First Edition and talking to you about your legacy and about how you see what we should be doing at this time. Up next, we speak Thank you, sir. Up next, we speak with local pastors about the responsibility of the church in Baltimore City and what we should be doing to address race issues. Right after this short break, stay with us. I'm Dr. K. This is First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Later in the next hour, we'll speak to Baynard Woods and Brandon Soderberg from the City Paper, talking about a national conversation on bringing down these Confederate statues. But first, let's continue our conversation about religion and race, and what is the responsibility of the church in regards to race issues? How do we address these topics in the church, and what do we do in our neighborhood to connect the church to what's happening in the world? To discuss, I'm joined by Reverend Michael Crawford. He's the lead pastor of Freedom Church and State Director of Missions for the Baptist Convention of Maryland and Delaware. Good evening, Reverend Crawford. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we're also going to be joined by Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, the pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, and he will be joining us shortly. Until he arrives, let's talk a little bit about Freedom Church. I've heard you've been doing some very exciting things over there. If you can talk a bit about the work that you did after we came out of the Baltimore ceasefire, what you did on that Sunday to connect what was happening in the city to what the church should be doing.
Yeah, thanks so much. What we did is we took the names at the time, as of Saturday, there were 208 homicides. We took all of those names. You could find them on Baltimore Sun. We wrote the names, their age, the place where they were killed, and we put them on the seats of our church. And then, unfortunately, 209 and 210 happened overnight. So we wrote them down, but the names weren't released, and I held those in my hand. I put them in the seats because I think we've gotten too used to walking around stuff like this. And I think God doesn't want us to do that. I think the church has not even been in the stadium, let alone, a participant on the field. And I want our church actually engaged. And so we took those names. And I spoke on the parable of the Good Samaritan, and I said, if we're not careful, we're the priest and the Levite walking around the person in need. Mm-hmm. And I said that when someone gets killed, it's not just that they lost a life, but it's their family and all of the connections and all of the kids who see that, the PTSD that goes through that community and our city, and we need to engage ourselves. So I commissioned a church. I said, you're going to take one or two of these names home, and you're going to pray for their families throughout the rest of this year. And I just met with a woman in our church, and she was weeping today. She was telling me about how she has two names right where she sits most of the time in her house, and they're right in front of her. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about the transformative nature of keeping that in front of you because we're so distracted, mm-hmm. and it just becomes nothing to us. So we did that, and I'm just trying to call the church to alertness and to be the Good Samaritan that's willing to walk into the mess and with God's help do something.
Well, let's kind of talk a bit about how race is a part of this. And I want to ask our listeners, if you want to join this conversation and you want to talk about what you're doing at your church or what you think should be done, give us a call at 410-319-8888. We would love to hear from you. So I just want to kind of frame this. You are African American.
Yeah.
And your church, is it a predominantly African American church or is it a diverse church?
It looks like the city, so there is some diversity in it.
There's some
predominantly African American, but it's some diversity in there.
Okay, so coming during the time of Black Lives Matter, the reason why I asked you this is because there was a whole campaign on Twitter by Reverend Andre Johnson, and his whole idea was, where is the white church
doing
Black Lives Matter?
Right.
Where does race fit into this? I know that African American churches, or led by African American pastors, are jumping into the fray because this is kind of part and parcel, not just part of your community, part of your life experience, but you see it directly connecting to the work that we do as Christians.
Right.
What about when you have silence from the white church, or you have different views from evangelical Christians?
Yeah, it's really tough because when you're a minority, you know that silence is not silence.
Mm-hmm.
It's often louder than a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And we are well acquainted with history and what a tremendous impact all that makes. And so I believe that sometimes the reason why you don't hear from the white evangelical is sometimes it's because of apathy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think it's because of politics. Sometimes it's because of fear. Again, I was talking to someone today, and they said this was the first church, our church, that they ever came to, that they actually saw a true and real integration and people really, really loving each other. There's no doubt about it that when you talk about like a right view of people, viewing people in God's image, everybody in God's image, I think our nation was founded on racism. I think racism is the mother of war. It's the mother of oppression. It's the father of war. And so you've got racism starting the country with Indians that moves to African Americans, and it's systemic. So this is not something that you can just look at and see as it's some little thing. I think it's built in. And my contention in terms of that is some denominations, some churches and some institutions, including our government, have never really repented of racism. Like I told our church, you know, our mayor took down the statues in the middle of the night. In my opinion, the people who put them up should have took them down.
Mm.
If we really believe that it is racism is evil, not just a political view, but evil, people talk about free speech. In Germany, you can't fly a Nazi flag.
Right.
You can't walk down the streets like these people did in Charlottesville, Virginia. You get arrested. You know why? They drew a line in the sand. They said, never again will this ideology, which is murderous, violent, and has no place in our country, will have it here. So I think one of the reasons why you don't see that is because some of the people who I might call brother and sister have never really repented and really embrace God's view of all mankind truly being equal.
Well, let me pull Reverend Heber Brown into the conversation. Hello, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We haven't been on the air together in a long time.
It's been a minute.
And there's been a lot happening. So
absolutely.
I want to bring you in. And the reason why we wanted you here, Reverend Brown, is because you are on the ground with these issues. You often use the pulpit to kind of talk about this moral choice that people have to make around these issues. What is your response to what happened in Charlottesville? And then what is happening in Baltimore from Tent City to the pulling down of the Confederate statues? I want you to give me your whole life story in the next couple of minutes.
Sure. Yes. Easy. Yes. Absolutely. Well, I think what happened in Charlottesville is as American as apple pie. I mean, I think that it is, as Pastor just said, is very foundational to what this country has always been about. And so, you know, in terms of the Klan finding greater excitement to organize and mobilize, in terms of neo-Nazis and the like, that is a part of the American story. And I think another slice of the American story also is those who continue to organize and mobilize against that, those thoughts and those ideas and that basic worldview. In terms of the pastor just said a moment ago that racism is systemic to this country. Wholeheartedly agree. Whether it's named or not, or whether it's obvious or not, it's there. And at this particular stage, I am looking at ways that I can be, and our church at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church can be, helpful in a systemic response to a systemic problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I think whenever women and men of faith and conscience get together, our immediate launching out is around the moral authority,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that moral authority is powerful. and that power can also flow into feeding systemic authority as well, particularly as it relates to the black church. I mean, I'm one of the biggest fans of the black church in the world because the bosom of the black church has produced institutions largely in response to white supremacy for more than 300, 400 some years. Mm-hmm. And many of those institutions are still here to this day. In fact, the institution we're sitting in right now, Morgan State University, it was black people of faith who helped to organize and to this day helped to lead it. And there's so many other institutes, hospitals, clinics, libraries, everything that we've needed. Before we had nonprofits and foundations everywhere, we had the black church.
Right. My.
And that was the center and the hub of our community in so many ways. What I'm trying to do now with varying degrees of success is try to get more younger activists and organizers today who may have a more critical view of the church, and that view in many respects is very well, you know, very valid. But I want them to see that there was something about why their elders and ancestors invested so much into pushing forward this institution called the Black Church. For instance, and just real quick and I'm done, the Black Church put, some of your listeners will want to put religion all to the side. Okay, let's put it to the side for a second then. Let's look at the other things that the Black Church does. Pastor can tell you, and you as a PK, a preacher's kid, know, so many people come and knock on the door to this day when their rent is due, when their utilities are due, when there's an emergency and their grandson or granddaughter's in trouble with the law. I can't tell you how many times I've been down, a pastor has as well, been down at the jailhouse, the courthouse, the hospital, down every step of the way. We've been there as a source of advocacy. And then in terms of cooperative economics, every black church may not have Kwanzaa flags flying from the sanctuary, but we practice the principles of Kwanzaa in some cases more so than the people who talk about Kwanzaa. So cooperative economics, I got you can get a church of 100, maybe 50 people who will raise $150,000 to $200,000 a year with 150 folk, just committed, just looking at the marathon of building up black-led institutions that respond to these systemic issues in this way. If 150 folk can put together $200,000 every year for 5 years, you got $1 million that has flowed through that church. There is no institution, organization in our community that can do that without foundation or corporate sponsorship. The black church is the only place that can raise that kind of capital and fund the type of things that we need done. So my plea to everybody listening, go to church on Sunday and stay in church. And, you know, you don't have to agree with everything. You don't agree with everything in your own family, but you still show up at the cookout.
Right.
Go to church, invest your time, your energy, your expertise, and stop lobbing rocks across the street. Bring your ideas inside and help to build together.
Well, let's talk about where the black church stands. I mean, because Reverend Brown, you brought up some very good points about the history of the black church and how the black church was a place to organize. It wasn't just about telling people, go to church. Everybody went to church because that's where the news was. That's where we met for the civil rights movement. If you think about, you know, our whole campaign in Birmingham, campaigns in Alabama, it was all about let's meet at the black church, get built up, and get ready for the next day. But if you think about what's happening now, people are not looking to the church for this moral authority. I mean, I agree with what Reverend Brown is saying, but people don't see the black church as a center of moral authority, the center to help us get organized. They're organizing outside the church. So where is the black church today? What's the role of it?
You know, that's a great question. Pastor couldn't have said that better. I think there's some potential reasons and ways to answer that question. One is, let's just be honest. We're both pastors. You're a PK. Let's be honest. Not all churches are equal.
Right.
I mean, there's some jacked up churches that probably the buildings at least probably, well, I want to say they need to be burned down, but we could use them, right, Pastor? Let's be honest. And then secondly, there's some people running some churches, not all churches, that need to go. They're charlatans, they're pranksters, they're greedy. They're all about money. You know what I'm saying? They don't do anything for the community. They're not teaching the truth. And let's be honest, there's a lot of what I would call kind of go to church churches where people go to the building, they meet at the building, and that's all they do. They don't use the building for the community. They're not trying to do anything in the community. In other words, I think every church should be the most valuable piece of real estate in the community. That's the way it was. Where did we slip? because we started building platforms. People started walking around with armor bearers and all this nonsense. Mm. And so part of this is we're going to have to repudiate the nonsense, start telling the truth. That's from the inside. But the other part of it is I think this is what we were talking about earlier. I think we have lost our moral way in the church. And we this is what I believe. We've become kind of practical agnostics. If you listen to most people preach, And you didn't know any better, you would believe we don't even have physical bodies. Mm. You would believe we don't even eat food. We don't cry. We don't emote. You would think we're just floating around. Spirits need to be saved in Jesus' name. All this spiritual talk. We are embodied souls. We have bodies.
Right.
You punch me, I feel that. Mm-hmm. When I don't eat, I'm hungry. When my sister dies of cancer, my body hurts. Mm-hmm. And the church needs to speak to those real body issues. And so we're dysfunctional inside sometimes, and then we have this truncated view of humanity, which speaks to the soul. So if you come to my church hungry, I want to give you a sermon. You need something to eat first. You know what I'm saying? If you're worried about how whether your kids are going to get shot or not, you want to give me a Bible study. You're worried about safety.
Right.
And I'll say this, and then I'll shut up. We have this demarcation that is couldn't be more silly. This whole thing of separation of church and state. I was political studies major, so I get this. I think one of the reasons why the church is absent is because they believe that nonsense.
Right.
They believe, they let the government say, you guys can gather in your building on Sunday mornings, and you guys can do whatever you want in there. And guess what? Here's a little secret. You don't have to pay taxes. And the church goes, yay! And then the government says, and the society says, now here's the only rule. Y'all keep that to yourself. And you let us politicians and legislators and political parties handle all the moral and social economic issues. And the church goes, yes, massa, I'll do that. And we need to say, wrong. We getting out in the mix.
Now, if you're just joining us, this is not Sunday morning, although it feels like it, because folks up in here preaching about what we should do and what is the moral authority. You're listening to First Edition. This is Dr. K. I'm sitting in for Sean Yost. We're on WEAA 88.9 FM. We're talking with Reverend Michael Crawford, lead pastor of Freedom Church, and he's also the state director of missions for the Baptist Convention of Maryland and Delaware. And we're talking to Reverend Dr. Heber Brown. The third from Pleasant Hope Baptist Church. Reverend Brown, let me come back to you, because I know you did a lot of work doing Black Lives Matter, helping young people to work through these issues. I know you were working with students from Loyola and from Morgan and Hopkins, and they were flocking to your church looking for answers. So now that we're going back into school, and it seems like the environment has changed, not just the election of Trump, but also the rise of the continuation of white supremacy under a new name.
Right.
How should African Americans, students in particular, talk to their white friends about this issue?
Oh, man.
So how do you frame this?
I would say to students, black students in particular, first, get straight on your own history first. You know, don't. I don't personally prioritize educating white people about anything, because many of my colleagues who do that work in terms of teaching white folks about privilege and racism, and I've done a lot of that work as well, as you know.
Yes.
It's important work, but it is it can drain the life out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get finished talking to white folk, you ain't got nothing to say to your own folk.
Ooh, okay.
And I have an urgency in my life right now, and I feel, I don't want to say a biological clock, but I feel something going on inside. Whatever difference you're going to make, whatever thing you're going to do, get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spend the time that I have left trying to convince white folk. I would tell black young people as well, listen, don't prioritize white folk. Go on white folk all day long. Listen,
right.
Prioritize studying your history. And oftentimes you got to unlearn what you learned in school, because K-12 gave you Dr. King, a caricature of Dr. King, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, and Frederick Douglass. But they didn't tell you about Albert Clegg. They didn't tell you about Thomas Sankara. They didn't tell you about Kwame Nkrumah.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't tell you about the continent. So you really, by the time you graduate high school and you give a little paper to say you know something, really you got to unknow what you think you know,
right.
So you can begin laying a foundation for self-knowledge and your own community. So that's what I would say. Don't go on to particularly students on predominantly white institutions Don't make it your mission to convert all the white students on campus to the way you see the world. Get huddle up, create little maroon communities on that PWI campus, little enclaves of black students who study together, encourage one another, support each other, and link to institutions in the community that can give you support, and make that your priority. It's not your job to raise white students on campus. It's your job to grow up yourself. And so make that the priority and link with elders and those that, such as yourself, other professors on campus, other pastors in the community who can help guide and shape some of the support that you need, and that you can give some of that genius to local organizations in the community that, you know, can stand to be built up a little bit more. Because for every one of the charlatans that Pastor just spoke about, there's 10 pastors who, given the best that they have, doing the best that they know, staying up late, getting up early, taking their own salary to fund ministry, and people say, oh, Pastor got all the money. That money go right back into the church. Y'all better believe that. It goes right back into the ministry. Yep. And we could stand to use more hands on deck from these young freedom fighters and change makers. Let's build up the institutions that we own and lead and fund ourselves.
Reverend Crawford, so what do you think? I see you shaking your head, and I hear amen. But yeah, if you wanted to speak to this, we'd love to hear your voice.
Yeah, you know what I think? I think a lot of young people are interested in the church because the church is boring. I mean, I'm a pastor. I've been a Christian 30 years. I love Jesus. By the way, it's ironic when we talk about race stuff. It's really ironic, especially like white supremacists, because Jesus was Jewish.
Yeah.
Like, it's really funny. But anyway, I think, it's been said that if religion's worth anything, it's worth everything. And I think if we're having trouble mobilizing a movement, a lot of times it's because there's no purpose in the movement. And so I think one of the things we need to do better as a church is not just give people something worth living for, but something worthy of dying for. And I think when we get these causes like Black Lives Matters and things like this, kids respond to that. And another thing I'm going to tell you that I think is really important is that God's convicted me of is the future's behind us. I couldn't agree more with what Pastor says. I'm going up to young men, 20, 25, 30 years old. I'm almost 50. And I'm looking them in the eyes and saying, y'all need to be ready. But in order for them to be ready, we've got to stop this secessionism that exists sometimes in the church where it's just about one guy. You know what I mean, Pastor?
Yeah, yeah.
And
right,
he's
right.
there for 50 years, we're waiting for the next person to get in, and he reigns for 50 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the young kids don't see, where's my place in the church? So what we do is we do some tokenism. We'll do kids' church once a year.
Yeah.
Listen, when you read your Bible, you realize Josiah was a king when he was 8.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about this in what we would call redemptive history, biblical history, we know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were kids turning upside down the kingdom of Babylon. These young kids have a lot of things we don't. They may lack life experience, but they got energy and zeal, and they don't need all the sleep that I need. And so what I'm saying, Professor, is that we need to better engage these young people, but that's going to mean we're going to actually have to trust God and create pathways for them into the church to actually become leaders. And the civil rights movement did that well. And the predominant demographic of the civil rights movement, they were young people.
Yeah.
Now, with that in mind, on Monday, we know that Reverend Al Sharpton has invited faith leaders. I think he's leading 1,000 faith leaders, and he wants everyone to come down to join to march. He was arguing in the segment before this one about the moral authority. And I asked him this question, that with this moral authority he's talking about, with these faith leaders, where is the place for the young people? If it's the leaders of the church who have this moral authority to speak, what about young people who are living in Freddie Gray's neighborhood, saying, I don't go to church, but I know about police brutality. I may not be able to articulate like you do, but I do know what it means to be afraid when cops come into my neighborhood targeting me. What do we say to them, Reverend Brown? What do they fit into what's happening over the next couple of days as we remember the March on Washington?
I think, one of the reasons why I was a little bit late tonight, I was practically flying almost directly in from Birmingham, Alabama. I'm just getting back home from Birmingham. And it was amazing to see. I was at the 16th Street Baptist Church where the 4 young girls died in the tragic bombing, and 2 young black boys also died in the same day. And so seeing that church, seeing the other institutions around in that community, they did a memorial for all the young people who were protesting and actually going to jail, filling up the jails, and just taunting white supremacy to its face, mm-hmm. and saying we're not afraid anymore. And so when the movement did not make room for young people made room for themselves.
Right. That's right.
And the leaders got behind the young people, because without those young people in Birmingham during that time, what they called the Children's Campaign, mm-hmm. without those young people, the campaign was about to fall apart.
Yes, it was.
Because many of the adults were not going up to the front lines and not trying to be a part of that.
King was already in prison.
Yeah.
Dick Gregory had arrived. They arrested him that same day.
Yeah.
So who was left?
Yeah, the children stepped mm-hmm. up. And so I think, you know, in that same way, and Pastor said a moment ago, creating avenues for that genius, that energy, that innovative thinking to flow in and through and to the black church, I think is very important. We started our Aretas Cross Freedom School at mm-hmm. our church.
Yes.
African-centered school, independent. We're not a charter school. We're not a Baltimore City public school. We're a program. We bring young people together. We talk about African history. We talk about social justice and also hands-on learning and self-sufficiency. Another thing that flows out the bosom of our church, the Black Church Food Security Network. Mm. Our organized churches all over the country now. We have about 13 in Baltimore, growing food on land they already own to address the issue of food insecurity in our community. We can't food pantry our way to power in this situation. Mm-hmm. We can't wait for nonprofits to feed us. We'll never be filled if we wait on nonprofits and foundations. So, but these are two things. These are two avenues that for young people, and particularly young black people who say, what can I do to help and how can the church be relevant to this? Well, we got a school, right? And mm-hmm. you can't have a movement if other people are educating your children, right? And you turn your children, you know, we wouldn't expect Jews to turn their children over to Germans. Mm. We wouldn't do it. They wouldn't allow them to tell that. So what we're showing and demonstrating is the importance of us laying that foundation for our children so they won't have to go through the process of unlearning because we got the foundation straight. And with the food piece, how are you going to lead a movement if you ain't got no food? You're not eating anything, right? And so whoever controls your food controls you. And so in these two ways, education and food, and we can't do everything. Every church had a unique fingerprint. But in food and education, we see this as the work of our ministry, but also it's revolution work. Mm-hmm. Somebody, I mean, we can't march all day. I bet you after them preachers march on Monday, they're going to go eat some chicken somewhere.
Somewhere.
They're going to eat somewhere, right? And it's something that we go and we have these, you know, liberation, freedom, these marches, right? And then you go eat at institutions and corporations that do not have the best interests of your community. You give your money over right after your freedom march, mm-hmm. give your money over to an institution outside of your community. Mm-hmm. So I'm working now, and I'm, you know, from Birmingham to Dallas to Baltimore, all over, organizing churches. Listen, stop just cutting the grass at your church.
Right.
Grow food in that, and let's build enterprise where we feed ourselves and put them church buses to work to move that produce from church to church. That's what I'm doing right now. And if young freedom fighters and change makers can't see the revolution in feeding yourself and educating your own children, I don't know what else to tell you.
So those are, for you, the unique fingerprints of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Education, food, revolution work.
Yeah.
Reverend Crawford, how about over at your church, at Freedom Church? What's your unique fingerprint? What exactly are you doing over there to move us, not just as a people, you know, as African Americans, but as a community and as a city, move us forward into where we really need to be?
Yeah, it'd be a couple things. One of them, a big piece of it, would be teaching, and really a holistic teaching. You know, this Sunday I spoke on the subject of racism from a holistic point of view, just try to really explain that from a biblical point of view, that we're all created in God's image. That we're all commissioned with the dominion in the chapters of in Genesis, and that what's gone wrong is that there's something systemically wrong with humanity, mm-hmm. and define what racism is. So education, right, what Pastor says, is really important. And for me, my heart beats at leadership development.
Mm.
When I see a young man, particularly a young man, but young women as well, I see the future. The future is behind us. And I'm telling you, if we don't invest in them and equip them and help them to be young leaders and wise leaders and educated and put them on the right path, we're heading for even a bigger disaster. And so that's where my heart beats. I like to gather with these guys. We've got not only preaching lab, but just discipleship. We're big on self-awareness, giving them self-awareness tools to do that with, and also inspiration. And, you know, I've been able, by God's grace, to take some young men in our church who came and they didn't know what direction to go in, and see them go to college and see them get a good job and see them get married and have kids and actually be able to flip it. And all I've ever ever asked of anybody I invest in is, when you get to that place, you turn around and do the same thing to other people. And if we can get young people and invest in those young people, see them raise up and see them reinvest, we can start a cycle and we can create a legacy. So my passion is really leadership development, because leaders rule the world. You got good ones, it's good. If you got bad ones, it ain't good.
And we got some situations when it's bad. We're going to leave it there. And I know for a fact that Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, the pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, will be there on Sunday morning.
I'm so preaching. Folks, come to church.
Come to church on Sunday morning.
Go to church.
I'm going to tell you, that's the second place. If you don't go to Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, go over to the Freedom Church with Reverend Michael Crawford, who's the lead pastor. He will be there preaching, talking about the ways in which we can be the moral authority. We go out of here thinking exactly what you said, Reverend Crawford. The future is behind us. And if you're of our generation, well, you need to think about the fact that your future isn't going to be very long coming. That fierce urgency of now that Heber Brown talked about. Don't change the dial. Stay with us, because we're going to talk more about the Confederate statues and what we should be thinking about as we begin to change this country that we live in. This is Dr. K sitting in for Sean Yost on First Edition, WEAA 88.9 FM. Stay with us.